Just a quick apology for the state of Paul's audio on this podcast. It's a bit crackly and echoey, but please forgive him as he hasn't been doing this long.
Hello and welcome to the BOAG World Show, the longest running web design podcast where we look at user experience design, conversion optimization and working in the web. On this show, we're going to be discussing building products versus running agencies. Also, we're going to be looking at an app that takes the hassle out of posting to social media. And finally, we're going to look how AI can breathe new life to things like user personas. My name is Paul Boag, and joining me, as always, is Marcus. Hello, Marcus.
Hello, Paul. How are you today?
Very, very well. But we're also being joined by Stu Green. Hello, Stu. How are you?
Hello, hello. I'm very good. Thank you.
So, I met Stu, as we talked out a minute ago, about a month ago, Marcus.
Mm-hmm.
And Stu is theoretically living the dream. I say theoretically because the reality is often very different.
Well, is he retired?
No, not dream. No, not quite that. So I met Stu about a month ago, and he's living the dream. Well, at least theoretically living the dream. I say this, but what I mean by that is, no, Marcus, it's not because he's retired. It's because. Stu, your background was in agencies, but you also done very well in products. Is that correct? Did it happen that way round, or did you jump straight into product design?
Yeah. I used to do a lot of sort of agency work. Gosh, this was before. Oh man, now I'm really sounding old. But before 2010, I was doing like kind of agency stuff, where either running my own kind of consultancy business, or I was working for an agency. I used to work for an agency in London. In Shoreditch, actually, and that was fun. I used to do a lot of front-end design and development. Okay. And then basically created my own app in about 2011 for project management. Mm-hmm. And, designed and built the whole thing by myself using tools that made it easy to build apps, you know, without having a ton of knowledge in coding. Because I'm kind of I didn't go through school. I kind of quit, and I'm the kind of guy that if you get a kit, I'll just start working on it without reading the instructions.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So that was my world, basically. That's how I did things. And then so I built an app in 2010, and scaled it till about 2015, 2016, and sold it basically. And then I repeated that again after that. So yeah, that's kind of been my compacted into a very small 1 minute segment.
Whenever you talk to agency, they always love the idea of, oh, we'll build an app and we'll go through the process of getting passive income, which I always think passive income is a bit of a lie anyway, because I know a lot of people who run apps and they work bloody hard for people that are supposedly having passive income. But it's the idea of swapping out one client for lots of customers instead. Yeah. Which is not just making the problem worse? Instead of a small number of clients that you have to please, you've got lots of customers. But anyway, I digress. So tell me, so many ways you are what would be today called, because it sounds a lot better than saying I kind of dropped out and messed around with a lot of tech, that you're now a unicorn. That's what you're supposed to be called, isn't it? Because you do a bit of everything. So, yeah, I'm going to be...
Go on. Aren't unicorns worth like $1 trillion or something like that?
Well, you know, probably.
I'm not.
No. Or maybe entrepreneur.
Yeah.
But then we've had those for years.
I hate the phrase unicorn so much. But I do think I should call you Stu the unicorn corn green now on for the rest of the podcast.
Oh, please.
No, sorry. Stunicorn, surely.
Stunicorn.
You're very good.
No, very that's good. Actually terrible. So what were these? So you built a project management app. You did it again with another app. What was the second one you did?
It was called Our Stack, and it was basically about time management.
Okay.
Because I just had two little kids at the time, and I was struggling to balance my work with everything else that was going on in my life. And I didn't have like those 8-hour chunks of day, that I used to have for doing design and development. So I built this called Hour Stack, and the idea was that you'd have little hour chunks of your time where you'd work, and then you kind of stack them. And that's I visualized that in my mind, and I ended up just designing it exactly like I saw in my mind, and the thing blew up and did really well. So.
Superb. So you sold both of those, did you? You had a two for two. Ah, yes. See. What? Yeah. How did you do that? It's like we built an app in Headscape back in the day. I mean, this was ages ago when me and Marcus used to work together. And
20 years ago.
We screwed it up from beginning to end, didn't we, basically, Marcus? It was a disaster for all the way through.
I have thoughts on why it didn't work out, but I'm not going to share them on here because I might get sort of done for defamation or something.
But I think
what I can take from that is we weren't, as in you, Paul, and me, and Chris maybe weren't. It wasn't our baby.
No,
there was a little bit of, oh, we're going to do this thing on the side, and it'll do great for us, but it wasn't our thing that we put our hearts into. We tried to do it very professionally, but it was potentially a good idea because there are other apps and other software has been developed to do this. It was basically to sign off design work, to give clients an area where they could go and look at designs and comment on it and that kind of thing. And I think it was possibly the first one that anyone had done.
We did do our research and we couldn't find anything else that did similar things. But
so it was just the implementation of it is where it went wrong. And I think part of that is because we didn't kind of own it strongly enough.
Yeah. But it was also, I don't think we were very good with dealing with, I don't think we're natural entrepreneurs, any of us, right? In the sense, I know we run our own business, but we're not like, you know, I've seen Stu work over the last month and he's kind of terrifying because he gets this, I want this new bit of functionality or whatever else we decide. And then he seems to, like 5 minutes later, he's produced it because he's this kind of dog with a bone. What was the one call? We were sitting on a call, an agency academy call, because Stu also runs an agency. We were sitting on the call last week and we got talking about his latest app, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. And Louise, who was on the call as well, said, oh, it'd be really good if it was integrated with Fathom. I got a call and there was a message from Stu going, yeah, I've done that, while we were chatting. I mean, that's unnatural. How do you work so fast? that's incredible.
That's the beauty of AI, my friend. Right. That's the beauty of AI.
Indeed.
What you squeeze out of AI is very, very impressive because I've spent quite a lot of time playing with these tools. And although I've built stuff, I found it sometimes quite a frustrating experience as well. But anyway, let's talk about the half the reason I wanted you on was to talk about the app that you're currently working on, because I want to sell it to Marcus, right? Marcus should sign up for this app. So do you want to briefly say what the app is, and then I'll convince Marcus that he should buy it.
Buy it? Actual money?
Yeah, you're going to spend money on it, Marcus. And you're going to be doing it live on the podcast and committing to lifetime value. Go on.
Right, sorry, Stu, go on.
So the app's called Bleat, and actually the guy we were talking about earlier, Nick, it was kind of actually his idea originally, and we kind of evolved it over time. But the idea is basically that, you know, in your agency or your small business, you have a lot of meetings and you talk a lot about different things. Like you might be talking to a client about what your product does or your business, and you might be sharing some expertise, you know, and you talk about all these different things in the meetings that you have all day, right? You're having all day having meetings, and then you finish your meetings and then you're like, man, I should be posting on social media. I had that really good insight with my coworker earlier, and I didn't record that, and man, I should have posted that on LinkedIn. Or and then days go by and you realize, you know, a month's gone by and you haven't actually shared anything on LinkedIn, and you feel guilty that you haven't actually done any social media, or you haven't shared with your network all the stuff that's been going on. And then you go, oh man, I need to, and then you write one big post and it kind of gets lost, and that's that. So as we know, with social media, you should be posting on a regular basis as often as you possibly can. So what this app does essentially is it will take those meetings, all your transcripts, or even if you have a thought, you can speak into it. But basically, it will take all of that content that you're speaking all day, and then it will basically extract topics from all of it, using AI, obviously. And then it will give you a list of all the different things you've spoken about in the meetings. And then from those topics, you can say, create me a post. But rather than using like AI slop, as we call it, where it just makes up stuff, it actually will use your verbatim quotes that you've said in the meetings and kind of piece them together. And you can actually choose how much you want it to be like verbatim, literally I said that word for word, or maybe throw in a little bit of flair like AI does. And yeah, essentially then you have that, and then you can then click to schedule it, put it on your LinkedIn or your X, and then you have content for maybe a week or so based on the meetings you've had that day. So that's Bleat for you.
That sounds great.
It's amazing, doesn't it? And what a great idea. Because it solves that fundamental problem of, well, there's kind of three fundamental problems I think it solves. First of all is, you know, if you sit down to write a social media post, you'll often sit there and go, oh, I don't know, I've got no ideas. I should say something intelligent, but what? It solves that. It solves that kind of problem of you know, these self-important best practice posts, because the tone of all these posts are going to be much more, oh, I was talking about this in a client meeting, or we had this discussion. So it's sharing your experiences rather than I, the all-knowing Paul Boag, which obviously I'm happy to do because I am all-knowing, but I, the all-knowing Paul Boag, bestow upon you my great wisdom. It's not that kind of stuff. And it's great because who's got the time to sit and do that? But you could write stuff. But if you can sit down once a week for 10 minutes and go, I'll have that one, that one, that one, that one, and schedule it up for the next week and you're done. I mean, that's brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so are you ready to sign up?
I'm wary of what I'm you know, suggesting here. It sounds very interesting, guys. I need to take it away and have a think about it.
Damn. We didn't manage to turn him on the meeting.
I don't do a lot. Yeah, yeah. This may be complete rubbish. What I'm about to say is I don't do tons and tons of meetings all the time. I have regular client meetings. That's a lot of following up on stuff, which might. This is where I'm kind of arguing with myself.
Yeah,
it's kind of there probably are really genuine, you know, kind of topics that come out of these calls that we have every week.
And that's the biggest problem, actually. One of the biggest problems that we've got to overcome, because I'm helping Stu work on this app, is that thing of, oh, well, my meetings are all boring and there's nothing in them, right? And I honestly felt the same, like, well, I'm just advising. But it's incredible what you can extract out of the most mundane meeting, and you don't really realize the value that's in these meetings until you kind of give it a go. So I get that. And also, you know, I had one meeting last week. I can't even remember what it was, but it was a fairly dull meeting. It managed to pull out six topics from that one meeting, right? And that was enough to do almost a week. If you post once a day, that's almost a week done just from one meeting.
I can share like a little bit of an example as well. Like, so I have a coworker in my agency that I work with, and often I'll get into the office and he'll be like, did you see that article I posted to you? I'll be like, yeah, I briefly looked at it. And he goes, it was interesting, isn't it, that it's doing this and this and this. I was like, well, why is it doing this? Well, because of this. And then the next thing you know, he's getting the whiteboard markers out and he's drawing this stuff up. And I'll be sharing my thoughts and my concerns. We have this like half an hour chat about some really cool stuff. And then afterwards I'll be like, man, we didn't record any of that. And that itself could have been a bunch of content that we could have posted. But the problem is we didn't actually set that as a meeting. We didn't record it. So it's gone. It's lost, you know. But, you know, whether you actually should set those up as meetings or whatever, the point is the content is being spoken. It's just not being done. Nothing's being done with it.
But thinking it through a little bit more, I'm thinking that potentially, because I've never done this before with the meetings that I regularly have, there probably is a whole chunk of stuff there. I think it might run out because we tend to cover the same stuff a lot of the time.
But Marcus, you could say the same is true of this podcast. I mean, we've been doing this since.
No, but you're a master, Paul, of reuse.
Well, yeah, but that's what you do, right?
Of course.
You're doing the same thing with your meetings. Yeah, you'll repeat stuff, but AI will write it slightly differently next time round, and it's 2 years later, so no one's going to remember what you posted on social media 2 years ago anyway.
So how do you get around, I don't know, upsetting your clients because you've said stuff?
Yeah.
That they wouldn't want you to say.
That's the number one objection in my little bit of research. And basically, the way that we're approaching it, I mean, Stu will be able to tell you more detail than I am, but basically, we strip out, it won't, what it creates doesn't mention any client names, it doesn't mention any, you know, people, any specifics. It, what it's doing is it's creating posts around the general topic, the idea, rather than the specific situation. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's, and I suppose if you thought, well, this is a bit too close to the bone, you just wouldn't yeah. publish it.
Yeah.
Or edit it.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. So I wanted to mention it. We always have an app on every time, and I figured that as Stu's here, it would be a good one to include. But what I really want to talk about with Stu is really this thing of building a product. Little bit of what's involved in building a product, a little bit of what's involved in running an agency, how the two compare, the relationship between the two. Because, Stu, you run an agency as well at the moment, don't you?
That's right, yeah. I just started it. It's called AI-logy, and basically the original intent was kind of be focused around AI and being sort of AI consultants. But now everyone is an AI consultant, right? So it's kind of like everyone is a master in AI now. So it's kind of like there's no point trying to... I feel like the proof is in the pudding. And we're focusing on building really cool stuff that, I've done for years. And it's kind of like now I'm working with people that are some of the smartest people I've had in my career working with me. So the idea is just to carry on building great products like we always did, but leveraging AI in that process.
I think it's very quickly we've moved into the period of time where AI now is just a tool in the arsenal. It's not a be all and end all in itself. It's like we went through the period of digital transformation where it was this thing, digital was this thing you had to plug into an organization, and now it's like, of course digital's a part of it. You can't do business without it. The one historically one that made me giggle when I read this was that when electricity first came on, we had chief electricity officers, people that were hired to do the electricity in organizations. and which is crazy these days. Obviously electricity is part of everything we do at every moment. And if it goes out, we don't work. And it's almost going to become like that with AI, isn't it? That it's not, it's just another tool, basically. So, yeah, I agree. Let's start by talking about that kind of agency versus product. You've run agencies, you've built products. I think those are two very different beasts.
I'm just going to dive in there because I had a question based on what you just said, Stu.
Okay.
So with your new agency, are you building apps for other people?
But are we building products for clients?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. In the old-fashioned way, too. Hey, we need a product. Sure, we can build it for you X amount of days, build a scope and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, for sure. But one idea that I'm sort of messing around with right now is, so I had a call with a founder of a company. She hasn't quite launched it yet, but she's got this idea to build this app around fitness and healthcare and tracking using like the Orb ring. I think it's the Aura ring.
Aura.
It's a really great idea, but she's got some money, but I don't think, it's this personal project, and she's kind of umming and ahhing about how she necessarily going to fund the fees, right? You say, well, it's going to cost, X amount of money, and it's like, okay, all right. And she's probably thinking in her head, how am I going to borrow money for it? How am I going to, put that money up front and then, pay for it? So, rather than just losing that deal, it's like, well, what about if we were to facilitate all of the hosting, the app store, like do all the sort of take ownership of the app essentially and kind of lease the services to them, right. So you're leasing the SaaS model essentially. It's like, well, we'll build it and we'll give you, you have to work out all the agreement and everything, but it's like, we'll give you, or you'll give us, 30%, 40%, whatever the arrangement is, maybe still pay a retainer monthly, maybe even still pay an upfront fee, but the amounts are going to be substantially less. And then there's a chance that if it does blow up, then we will do really well along with the client. But obviously it means taking some risk on. But if it's a really great idea that we want to be invested in, you could do that and you could have like 20 of those apps, right? Mm. And the beauty of that model, the other beauty of that model too, is that you have like champions mm-hmm. of the product. Mm-hmm. You don't have to do the marketing because they're doing it. They're excited. They're the ones actually going to promote the product and do all that hard work for you. And you just have to provide the infrastructure and the app development services. So
yeah, I've always loved the idea of being able to do that with our clients, but they're all, the kind of work we do just doesn't fit that model. But right. an app like that, or the apps that you're describing here, perfect. Yeah, again, if
we
get another
opportunity. We talked to year back. He ran an agency in Canada, some orange.
Silver orange.
Silver orange. And I can't remember.
Yes, that does ring a bell.
I can't remember the guy's name. Yeah, because it was a long time ago. They had that model with e-commerce, right?
They did.
So they would build the entire e-commerce site.
They were on the show.
They were responsible for it, the whole works. And they did a revenue sharing model. The way they made it work is by being incredibly picky over who they had that relationship with.
Daniel Burka.
Daniel Burka was one of the founders, but wasn't the guy we talked to about that. It was one of the other founders, but anyway.
Damn.
It's close, yeah. And they were very picky over who they picked. So in their case, they picked somebody who manufactured the items directly so that there wasn't any middleman stuff, which doesn't apply in your situation, Stu, but also had an established marketing channel, which is what you're talking about with your partners, isn't it? That you would need somebody who's either got an audience or can leverage an audience, or, you know, has that kind of thing. Is that right? Is that kind of what got in your head, that they deal with the marketing side, as you said?
Well, first of all, the fact you said leverage is making me, it's just because we say, well, the Americans say leverage. And I forgot that in Britain we say leverage.
Not all of us say that word at all.
Anyway,
I refuse.
You're out in America now. I think we need to clarify.
I've been here 12 years.
Yeah. You haven't lost
and
your
accent. I still can't get my head around when people say, "Oh, I like your pants," and I'm like,
"It's a little personal."
I was, as a little aside, it is connected. I was bought a book for Christmas, a typical Christmas book called Wankonomics, which is about how we all need to adopt the latest marketing bullshit to get ahead in life. Yes, leveraging the piece, for example, going forward,
yes.
Are all the language that, and the horrific part of it, I'm reading it going, I already say that.
Yeah. Shit. If you go down that route, which I think is a really interesting route, you're going to have to pick and choose your partners quite carefully, make sure that they can hold up their end of the bargain in terms of marketing it and promoting it. So, you know, that's the chance you've got with it. But it's a brilliant model.
I think that's why you kind of still maintain some kind of monthly contract and some kind of upfront fee, so that there's some skin in the game, that you've actually still made some money from it, but it's substantially cheaper than for the client than paying, you know, 50k and then losing the client altogether because they can't afford it.
Yeah, so no, it works.
You'd have to use it sparingly.
Yeah. So I'm quite interested in that kind of mindset or mind shift that has to go on between building stuff for clients and building your own thing, because obviously build stuff for clients, you only have to think about part of the overall thing. You know, you're worrying about the application, the building of it, while when it's your product, think about everything end to end. So how has that been for you, you know, in terms of how comfortable are you with the kind of marketing side of things, the building an audience, getting the word out there and all of that kind of stuff? Or has that been a bit of a shock?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it's always hard for people like me, creatives. I think you talk to any creative, whether they're like an artist, a musician, anyone that creates things always struggles to sell their own product, right? I mean, it's the problem we have as creatives is that we struggle to, we always throw our work away and as soon as we're done with it, even if it's a masterpiece. I'm not saying my work is a masterpiece, but you have to have a problem to solve, right? So you've got to have people that want to buy your product ultimately. And if you can have the best beautifully designed product in the world, and if no one wants to buy it, then there's really no point doing it. So if you start with that, you've at least got a few customers that are going to buy it. And I've always found that for me, I am my best customer. So like for me, those first two apps that I built, they were built for me. You know, I built them for my own agency.
Yeah.
You know, I needed a project management tool, and I didn't like any of the ones out there. But I needed this tool. I told you already, I needed a tool to manage my hours, so I built it for myself. And it's like if you genuinely are a good customer of your own product, there's going to be others like you. And then if there's two more, then great. If there's five more, 10 more,
but I think it's
sold itself.
The bit that we got stuck on, or part of the bit that we got stuck on, was, okay, so we built a product. We know that it's a product that somebody out there will want because we want it. So there must be people like us. Mm-hmm. But it's how to get in front of them. I mean, your products, did they just go viral? Was there some sharing mechanism? You know, how did it go like that? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of luck involved, right, to be honest with you. I mean, you've got to have your distribution channels. And like back in the day, when I say back in the day, like it was a lot easier because there was less noise.
Yeah.
You know, so I would go on a forum and say, hey, guys, I've built this product. What do you think? And not everyone was doing it. So it was kind of like, oh, that's cool. I had the boldness and the time to go out and build something. Whereas a lot of people are just working their 9 to 5.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, that's cool. Whereas now you have the challenge that everyone is building products. Everyone is doing it. It's so easy. So everything's just much more saturated. So you do need to have an element of luck. For the second product I built, I managed to get it in Asana, which is like a task management tool. I managed to get it like listed as their number one integration. And I think they forgot to update the page for a month or something. And it was just stuck there as like the top number one integration. And we just got piles and piles of traffic coming in. So that was kind of like, I guess, luck, a bit of a break.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was obviously still a product that people wanted. Otherwise, we wouldn't have made any money from it. So you've got to have your distribution channels. And I think you've got to have a bit of luck as well. I do think that.
100%. So that kind of brings us nicely on to how AI has influenced all of this. Because it's now easier to build apps than ever before, which means that there is a lot more saturation in the market. So I'm just interested in how you feel AI has either helped or hindered developing your own products.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I'm still exploring it, honestly. I think, you know, everyone out there now is building cool stuff. Like I'm on X, and I'm on these, you know, various channels and follow a bunch of people that are doing this stuff. And every day, I'm almost tired of doing it now, because every day I log in, someone has built something amazing. Like yesterday I logged in and someone had built like a full-on, you know, World of Warcraft RTS strategy game that looked amazing. And he's like, oh yeah, I kind of one-shotted this and built it last weekend. And I'm like, bro, this is just crazy. Like, how, you know, and it's insane. Like, everyone is building great product, quality products. Like, I was able to replicate this video hosting platform. It was like, I've forgotten the name of it now. But basically, you upload your course, your tutorial, and then other people will follow it.
Yeah.
And you know, they'll pay you for your content, essentially. And I said, I think all my prompt was like clone. I think it's school.com, SKOOL.com.
Yeah.
Clone school is basically my prompt. And they just went ahead and cloned the damn thing. And it looked great. I mean, obviously, I spent a few hours getting it like working and actually hosting videos and stuff like that. But within let's say 4 or 5 hours, I'd built this product, which was great. And I have still got it. And I'm like, well, who's going to buy it? Who's going to want it? I don't know, but I don't know if that answers your question.
I mean, this gets into the kind of stuff that does my head in a bit with this kind of thing. Is you went from going, oh, I one-shotted it, right? And then said, oh, but then I spent 4 or 5 hours getting it working, right? And there's a lot of people who are saying shit like that online. And there's a lot of, I entered this thing and I look at this amazing thing I got out of it. And it's not actually that simple. So I'm really fascinated. I'm fascinated as what tools you're using to make this happen. You know, what you go through in that iteration process. If there's any advice you can give me, please, to kind of help me to go from that. Okay, I feel like sometimes I give it a really good prompt, you know, really detailed, get into everything I need, and it produces something, and yeah, it kind of works, but then this particular edge case doesn't work, and I try and fix that, and then it breaks something else, and I feel like I quickly spiral out of control. Is that just me being stupid, or what are you doing that I'm not?
No, and I think that's a really good point you made there. It's like, it isn't true. It isn't true. People don't just one-shot stuff. Like, the honest truth is, with school.com, I did say clone it, and it did an amazing job of building this thing, right? But, and that was where it was impressive. And you could take screenshots of that. You could throw it on X and say, I one-shotted this. And that would be true. But there's that, like you say, there's the iteration of like, okay, now I've built this cool, like, facade.
Yeah.
But it's like, when you open the door, you realize it's just a Hollywood set and it's propped up by some beams. So it's like, you've now got to go through that door and you've got to start building the rest of the house, yeah, right? So that's what I do. And a lot of that does require years and years of product building experience. You know, you've got to know, oh, it needs hosting. Okay, it needs like a, for the video thing, it needed a thing called MUX, M-U-X, to actually host and serve the videos, right? Like a free or open source platform for that. And I actually had AI help me find that, because I didn't even know what MUX was. And then I was like, oh, it said, oh, we should use this service called MUX. I was like, okay. So, but that involves lots of prompting along the way, doesn't it? And then it's like, we need an S3 server. And then it's like, then we need all these different things. So, but it still requires you to kind of know what it needs so that you can prompt it to give you what it needs. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so, I think you need to know, in my experience with these tools, you need to know what questions to ask.
Right.
You need to know then what, when it responds to you, which of the options it gives you is the best, or whether they're all just made up rubbish. And also you need to know when you're getting sucked down a rabbit hole. The problem is you don't know what you don't know, or you don't know what you need to know, is probably what I'm thinking in a lot of situations. And so it's very easy. That's why I see these AI tools as being, there's almost two types in any scenario. There are the tools that will do very, very basic things that are one-shot tools for everybody, right? So they're, you know, I could create a very simple little app very easily with something like Lovable or something like that, where they do all the hosting, they worry about the database, and it'll just run on their site. And really, that's for my personal use. It's not for me to build a whole thing. And then there's tools for people that actually know what they're doing, like you, right? Like a proper developer, that are to enhance the ability for those professionals to do their job faster and better. Is that... I mean, I'm making this up, but that was what it feels like to me. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, absolutely. 100%, you know it. So like Lovable is great, but I can't imagine anyone... I'm sure it's been done, but I can't really imagine anyone going Lovable, spending... It's expensive. You know, it's spending a lot of money using Lovable, building an app, and then saying, hey, everyone, I've got an iOS app, an iPhone app in the App Store. Go use it, and it makes money, and then they're like relying on this as their business. I mean, I think that would be a bit of a dumb business strategy, because you're putting all your eggs in this platform that's only been around, I think, a year.
Yeah.
Just over a year. That's a lot of trust. And I like to know, I mean, for me personally, I like to know all the nuts and bolts. I want to look under the hood. I want to know how everything's put together for my apps that I built. And also the clients want to know that too. They want trust, right? So if they're hiring you, they're going to hire you because they trust you, right? Mm. That's the number one thing. And that's what I've learned in doing this agency stuff, is like the people that I'm getting, the leads I'm getting are actually friends,
yeah,
or friends of friends, because trust, right? I don't think people are going to just Google and say, oh, I'm going to go for the, I mean, maybe the top number one agency, because it's been well backed, might get the job. But I don't think people are just Googling and say, oh, look for an agency in Jacksonville to build my whole app. And then I think most of the time they'll say, hey, do you know a guy that would build this app really well? And they'll be like, oh, I know a guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's probably going off on a tangent, but you're right, Paul, that is it. We use, as product builders that have experience, we use tools like Cursor.
Yeah.
We'll use tools like Claude Code in the terminal.
Yeah.
You know, we'll have our own infrastructure. We'll use our own services that we rely on, and we'll piece it all together and deploy something that's actually, you know,
the key there, and I think, This is really important, and it's the difference between the two examples you gave, Paul. We will use tools like, what's the Figma one? Figma Make. To develop prototypes, and it's great for that.
Yeah.
But as soon as you want to have to, as soon as you have to support something and update it later for your client or whatever, you've got to know, to use your term, Stu, you've got to know what's under the hood and understand what's under the hood. Otherwise, you can't reliably support something that people are paying for.
The other way I've started to think about it is, if you look at the development cycle, you could almost split it down into three stages. The first stage is creating the prototype, the MVP, the proof of concept, whatever you want to call it. Then you've got the main, we're going to build this thing properly. This is our product. So it has to, you know, be secure. It has to be scalable. It has to be accessible, all of those kinds of things. And then the third part to the equation is, this thing has been launched and we want to iterate it and improve and change it. Now, in my mind, there are tools that are for that prototyping, proof of concept, little experimental stage. So things like Figma Make is one example. Even something like Lovable is another example. And people like you and me, Marcus, we can do that bit, right? Without a lot of knowledge. But then we need a grown-up to do the actual build, right? A specialist to do the main build. Now, once it's all been built and it looks great, right? So, for example, I've used my own website as an example. I got a developer called Ben to build my website, and he's built it right, and he's built it well, and he's built it professionally. Now, he probably used AI to help him do that, pair programming, working alongside it, all of that business. But now I go in and edit my own website with AI because there's a good, solid foundation of best practice that AI is working with, right? So I can now step back in with my limited knowledge and tweak it and improve it and do bits and bobs to it. So that's kind of how I'm beginning to structure things in my mind. And the big takeaway that I have from all of this is this shows you that AI is not going to take our jobs away. You're still, these are ultimately tools for professionals to use for the majority of things, even though, yeah, maybe there's a little bit at the edges. And I compare it to when I went to, you are old earlier, Stu, talking about 2010, right? When I went to art college, to study graphic design, right? And because the web didn't exist, okay? And while I was studying graphic design, this thing called desktop publishing came along, right? Where, and everybody was up in arms going, we'll never get a job now, because anybody can create their own flyer, their own poster, their own whatever. They don't need a graphic designer to do it anymore. Now, the reality is that for a while, that's what happened. And then a lot of people produced really shit posters and you know, flyers with Comic Sans and terrible colours in it. And so then you realise, well, actually, this is a tool for the professionals to use to take to the next level. But that doesn't mean that at the edges, people can't still make their own flyer for their local fete, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of how I'm seeing it.
Yeah. No, I love that analogy. That's so true.
Okay. Because I don't get to talk about it with anyone else. So I'm interested to hear from you, Stu, because, of course, you're deep in it. You know, whether I'm just going off on one, wondering whether, you know, deluding myself into thinking that I'm still relevant in the world or whether AI is going to replace me. But I don't think it is.
I think you're right, and I think like a lot of like any professional, like you think about someone that builds a house, right? The client has this dream house. What they picture in their mind is this beautiful house, and they can think about the windows, and they think about what the kitchen's going to look like, and that's what they think about, right? But you go to a professional, the professional's not going to go, oh yeah, those are really nice blinds and shutters, and yeah, that, you know, that for, you know, whatever, the colors you're choosing are great. They'll go, all right, cool. Well, first of all, we need to start with that 2D, you know, foundation plan. We need to do a survey. Mm. First of all, we need to check that you can actually build a house on that foundation, and they're going to work their way up, and they're going to hire professionals all along the way, and you kind of start with that foundation. Then you do the, you know, the base layer, and then you put all the I don't know, all the blocks in and everything, right? And then the last thing you do is then you're putting in the kitchen, then you're putting the shutters in, and it's like the last thing, right? So it's kind of like, it's the same thing, like you just mentioned, like when you have an app idea and you take it to a professional, the first thing they're going to do is like, okay, so we need to build the database layer. We need to architect it so that not only is it going to serve your needs, what you want in your mind, we're actually going to think ahead of that. And we're going to say, well, you're also going to probably add, you know, comments and community forum, and you're going to add, you know, real time, whatever. So you need a socket. And then they'll start thinking about all these things and put the foundation down so that then when the other pieces get put in, and as you say, the client goes, oh, actually, I just want to change the website. I want to redesign that website. You can still redesign the website, but all the bits underneath it, the forms, the contact pieces, the way it's all architected underneath don't change. And that is essentially why you hire a professional. Because otherwise, if you just say, build me this house and make it look like this, it'll get built and it'll look exactly like in your mind. But like I say, you're going to start using it and you're going to find that there's cracks in the walls and it's all going to fall down because there's no solid foundation. They didn't do a survey.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if that's a good analogy.
I think it's a really good analogy. We're approaching. I like it. Yeah. Yeah. That really drives home the level of detail.
Professional knowledge.
Yeah. Okay. So going back then, so we're seeing this massive influx of all these AI developed apps that are all appearing and stuff like that. And it's easier than for people to create apps than before. But there's a big difference between creating an app and having a sustained business, right? And something that makes money and you can support over the long term. So I'm interested from your perspective of what you look for when I no doubt, if you're anything like me, and I know you are, your head is full of ideas of things you could build, right? Mm-hmm. How do you decide which of those you think is the most viable to build?
Yeah, I mean, for myself, my own like projects. You mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I think like recently my thought is you've got to find people that have, you've got to find other people that you want to partner with.
Right.
Like, so for example, like I had this idea to build this app for running, an AI running coach app.
Yeah.
So like, say for example, you say, I want to run the London Marathon next year. You put that goal in and then the AI will say, okay, cool. Well, tomorrow you need to start with a 5K. And then next week we're going to do this and this and this and we're going to build up. And it creates this whole plan to get you to that London Marathon. But along the way, what it does is it uses something like a Garmin tracker, and then it actually checks that the run you're doing are actually in line with your plan.
Yeah.
That was my idea. Sounds cool, right? It's a great idea.
Well, I was out. I was out. Like I have to run 5K tomorrow. That was the point where I checked out. But in theory, it sounds like a cool idea.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah. And I, like I say, it's probably been done already. But the point is, like, that's an idea, right? If I was to then build that myself and then put it out there, like, what does even putting it out there mean? Like, who's gonna even use it, let alone like pay for it? I need to find someone that's gonna actually promote it with me, for me. Mm-hmm. So I was like, well, the best way to do that would be to find running coaches here in I live in Florida, in Jacksonville. So I was like texting some of the running coaches I know. I was like, well, what do you think of this idea? Thinking that if they were to say, that's a great idea, I want to do that, I could then say, all right, well, can you help promote it, distribute it with your networks, with your running, with your people that you're in your club, and I will we'll figure out some kind of arrangement, you know, or even do you want to go into business with me and like promote this with me as your app, and I'll do the you know, that was what I was thinking in my head, and I approached a couple of people, and they just were just like, it's a cool idea, but I use this, I'm reluctant because of this, or. Yeah, I'm not sure. They were like, that's cool though. You go for it, man. You do it. And I'm like, well, I don't want to do it by myself. I need someone to help me do it, you know, because I'm not just going to go and spend weeks and months trying to promote this thing, which probably no one's going to buy.
Yeah. That's genius. I think that's really good because I think it's genius for a couple of reasons. One is it's almost a first barrier to get an idea passed. If you can't get other people interested in investing in the idea and doing the idea with, it's probably not that great an idea in reality. And then secondly, if you do get past that and you do get someone to interested, then you've got a channel to market as well. You've got a way of getting getting to the audience and reaching people. So yeah, I like it.
Sorry, if you think about like real, and another great example is like, this is way back, but you think about Craigslist, right? That solved a problem. People just wanted to post things for free, yeah. right? And that app is still, I don't know, I haven't checked it, but the website's still, I think, the same as it was designed 20 years ago or whatever. It hasn't changed. So it doesn't matter about the design. It doesn't matter how great your product is. It doesn't matter if it's using all the latest bells and whistles and AI and it's amazing. If you're not actually solving a problem and no one wants to use your app, then it's completely pointless and waste of time.
I was going to say, no, I thought of a third on... at the points you were just making about finding somebody else to kind of work with on it, we were, just before you joined, Stu, we were talking about just the same kind of thing. My partner at Headscape, Chris, he is retiring. He's going down to 50%. I don't want him to go kind of thing, because I'll miss having that person to talk to about all the ideas and whatever it is we're working on. So finding somebody, that's kind of like the third point. If they were interested, you've then got a partner to kind of work with to develop the thing.
So, yeah. It really makes a difference having somebody you can bounce this kind of stuff off of. Says the man that makes money out of being that person that you can bounce stuff off of. So I would say that's important.
another thing I'll say is, like, I was chatting to a guy, a founder of an agency. He's actually used to be my old boss. And I think he's made some money and he's done well and he's kind of semi-retired. And he's like, had this idea, and he's like, hey, how could I... build this app? How can I add to it? How can I do all these different things? I'm willing to invest money in it. I've already spent like a lot of money, but I feel like it's missing this or that. I mean, can I hire you to do these things? And I was like, you know, and he's like, I tried selling it. I put it out for free at one point and people just used it for free. They didn't actually pay to use the freemium. They didn't pay anything. And I'm like, do you think that maybe you're flogging a dead horse? Yeah. Do you think it actually is any worth? There's no point putting any more money in this. I think you've proved the point that no one wants to buy this. They don't want to pay for it. Hmm. So just give up. And I think a lot of founders have this pride that they don't want to give up on their idea because they've already invested $100,000 in this thing and they just don't want to let it go because they think that... And sadly, sometimes you just have to let go of it and say it didn't work.
And that's one of the nice things that AI does give us. It gets us to that point where we can start trying to sell the product much, much faster at a much lower level of investment. Right. And you can find out whether that thing is got legs or not, which, you know, beforehand, you did have to sink $100,000 into getting something to work only to discover that it doesn't. Now it's more of a time sink than anything else, you know? I'm still a fan of the approach of building the landing page and trying to flog it when it doesn't actually exist yet. but maybe that's slightly unethical. I don't know. But
Bleat does exist, by the way. Yes, My app Bleat does actually exist.
Yeah, me talking about, yes, I've been involved. Everybody's going, oh, I'm not buying that then. It probably doesn't even exist. So, okay, one last question before we move on to one little thing before we wrap up. I'm quite interested in the fact that you've sold two apps, right? So, A, why did you sell them? And B, how did you know that now was the time to sell them?
That's a great question. Again, a little bit of luck, maybe.
Right.
Timing these things is always hard, right? You know, it's a bit like, I guess, when you're trading on the stock market or something, you know, you buy it, you know, sell at the top, right? It's kind of like that. For me, a lot of it was just like, I'm a creative. I was bored.
Yeah.
I was tired of it. Done. Like with these kind of businesses, you get to the point where they, with SaaS businesses, software as a service, you have this initial growth and then it kind of curves.
Yeah.
And then you get this thing called the plateau or the, you know, and that's when you kind of have your churn, which is when people leave your business versus your expansion revenue and your new customers. It kind of like, it's the same.
Yeah.
And you've got to watch out that your churn doesn't take your curve down and you end up losing money. Mm. So you always have to be thinking about getting new customers and making sure there's expansion. Anyway, my apps, both of them kind of got to that plateau.
Yeah.
And really, you have to either scale and sink more money in it and really grow it to get it continue to grow, or you just sell it, because that still has a lot of value to a lot of people. They want to buy something that's got $25,000 of recurring revenue every month.
Yeah.
Because they can either just let it sit in their products you know, with their other products, and they can use it to maybe help other products that they have. Or they might just be founders that are looking for a project to dive into, you know. So that's a good time to sell, really, is when you kind of see that plateau. And for me, especially as a creative, I'm like, I don't want to invest any more money. And B, I don't want to start hiring database consultants and customer success agents and doing the kind of the scale, which is the really, for me, the really boring part of the business. It's kind of like, I want to build stuff.
Yeah.
Right? I want to create new things. So it's like, sell that, take the cash, do something new.
Yeah. And that, and I like,
that's been my story.
I like that because that comes down to recognizing who you are and where your strengths lie. Because there will be people out there who their passion is for marketing and business growth and all of that kind of stuff. And they're the kind of people that should buy a product from you, right? So you've put the product in place. You've got it there. You've demonstrated the potential. Now they can run with it and make it happen. Mm. But yeah, I would be like you. I get bored of things very quickly, and I've got no desire to manage people. I've got no desire to deal with customer support. I can barely stand clients, and they, you know, they pay me a lot more money than individual customers. I really shouldn't say
and
things
all
like that.
Listening to you now.
You'll edit that bit out, won't you, Marcus? Mm. No, that bit's staying in. I thought it might be. No, that makes a lot of sense. So what, sorry, I said that was going to be last question, but I do want to know about what was the process of that? How do you sell a product? Did you get approached by somebody and you just said, yes, thank you very much? You know, or did you go looking for a buyer?
Put a sign on your window, Paul. Put a little sign on your window.
Yeah. I mean, there's lots of businesses out there that want to sell your product for you because they can make some money.
Yeah.
You know, they take a cut, like brokers, right? Yeah. So, if you get someone knocking on your door and saying, hey, I want to buy your business, then that's great. You don't have to pay anything to a broker. And so that's awesome. But it doesn't really happen very often unless you're like, you say, a unicorn and your name's Mark Zuckerberg or something. But yeah, for me, it was like, I want to sell it. I went out there and I found a broker that would sell it for me.
Okay.
And they took a cut. They took a cut, but they did a lot of the work for me.
Yeah.
They helped me write the letter of intent. They helped the client write the letter of intent. They helped me do my paperwork. They got involved with the deal. I obviously had to lose a lot of equity in the deal, a lot of value of the deal.
Yeah.
But after the deal, they did send me a nice box of chocolates. It was kind of...
Well,
there you go. Worth it for the chocolates alone. Oh, that's really interesting. Do you know, it had never occurred to me, it shows how little I know about this subject, that there are brokers out there that will do this for you. That's genius.
Oh, yeah.
That must take a lot of the hassle out of it. Because I wouldn't know where to start to sell something like a business.
No, it was fantastic. And I didn't mind, obviously, giving up that so that I could get a broker to do it because they handled the whole thing.
Yeah.
And it was awesome. And they kind of protect both parties too. So you've kind of got that kind of middleman and middle person. So
yeah, sounds great. Cool. That was really interesting, Stu. Thank you so much. If nothing else, you've helped me to think through a lot of things in my own head, especially around where things are going and what's happening at the moment. But I'm not as experienced in the product side of things, so it's an area that constantly interests me and I'm really into. But I did want to share, before we finish, I try and share some reading that you might want to check out over the coming week. Or month, should I say, until we do the next one. And this time I'm going with a couple of posts that I've written for Smashing Magazine on the use of personas that are a thing that have been around donkey's years. And to be frank, are a bit rubbish. These are the things that you create and then they end up sitting in a drawer somewhere and nobody refers to them. But I've really taken to them again as a tool, but using AI as a big part of their creation. So there are two articles that will both be in the show notes. So you can go to boag.world/031. We're on number 31. That's right, aren't we, Marcus? 31.
Yes, 31, yeah. Yes.
So, and you'll find links to both of these posts. And essentially, what I've done on recent projects and what I've written up is I've taken all of my research into users, which might be surveys, user interviews, anything that the organization has already got, things like call logs, customer call logs, anything like that. I also get Perplexity to do online, deep online research into what people's questions are, what their tasks are, their objections and their pain points. And then I take all of that and I get AI to create really, really detailed personas on my audience, right? Far more detailed than you would do in a traditional persona. Most traditional personas fit on a single piece of A4 paper. These are very, very detailed personas. The AI does all the hard work. It collates all the information, puts it all together. And then once I've done that, then I can basically take all of those personas and I put them into an AI project. So if you're using ChatGPT or Claude, I would create a project for them. Or a custom GPT, if you're using Google Gemini, I'd use a Gem, which is their dumb name for a project. And then those will be reference material. And then basically I write instructions that say, answer questions based on what the personas would think. Okay, it's longer and more complicated than that. So now you've got this thing where essentially you can say, I was thinking about adding this new feature. What would my audience think of it? And it's pulling on these personas to be able to predict what people might say about it. Now, is that as good as user research? No. But the difference is that it's you can do that in every meeting, every people who have nothing to do with user research or user testing can reference it at any time in their job whatsoever. So when I've done this, for example, recently with a fashion retailer, an e-commerce site that sells fashion goods, I've put all of this together. And now the product team, when they're trying to work out what next year's lineup may be, you know, they can upload photos of different outfits and go, what would these different audiences think of it? The website team can upload wireframes and say, how would the audience respond to it? And it will pull on all of this data to make a reasonable guess about what people might do. To a much more frequent level than you could ever do user research on. You can't test every single question anyone ever has. And I found it really exciting. I found it really useful. And if you want to know the details of how to do it, then check out the show notes where I go into it in a lot more detail. I was really scared that I'd already covered this before on the podcast, but Marcus doesn't seem to be glazing over too much, which means that it might be new information to him.
Oh, no, I really was properly glazing over. What were you talking about?
I walked right into that.
You have mentioned AI-produced personas before, but not to that level, Paul.
Okay. Well, it's the articles teach you how to do all of this, and it's my in thing at the moment. I'm in that, you know, when you encounter a new thing that you get excited by, it suddenly becomes the hammer that fixes every nail, you know? I'm using it even when it's not appropriate to use it, really, because I'm into it. But anyway, that's beside the point. Stu, I've got some bad news to break to you because I don't think you're a regular listener of the podcast. There is the horrible thing that we have to do every show, which is Marcus has to tell a joke. Mm-hmm. And the years, we've tried many times to drop this from the format. Every time we do, people are quite happy for us to change anything else about the podcast, but we're not allowed to change the cook. So just brace yourself. It's quite distressing. Marcus. Look,
this is a joke from a real comedian called Masai Graham. Okay.
Okay.
And I picked it because it's so bad. And it's one that I know you'll love, Paul.
Oh, it's one of those terrible puns.
So I tried to steal spaghetti from the shop, but the female guard saw me and I couldn't get pasta. Got a ha, excellent.
Yeah. That's even my camera seems to be shaking its head
shaking
at
its
you.
Head.
It's
yeah,
going
yeah.
back, backwards and forwards randomly.
Well, Marcus, I mean, it reminds me that I used to play piano by ear. But now I'd use my hands instead.
See, that's a better one. I like that one.
No, it isn't. It isn't. It's worse, but I like jokes like that. So,
anyway, I think
double jokes. Everyone's very, very lucky this week. Two jokes.
Two jokes are the price of one. What more people want? from my life. Okay, we'll wrap it up at that. Stu, thanks so much for coming on.
Yes, thank
really
you.
Appreciate it.
And
I hope people found it useful. I certainly did. And we'll talk to you again soon. Thank you. Bye-bye.